Inside Florida Politics, the essential podcast powered by Gatehouse Florida. I'm Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett, still unsigned by any ball club as spring training begins here in Florida. And I'm joined, as always, by the five-tool talents of Sarasota Herald Tribune politics editor Zach Anderson.
Hey, George.
And from Tallahassee by the veteran power hitter who brings a lot of intangibles to the clubhouse, Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief John Kennedy.
Hi, George.
Well, President Donald Trump was in Florida for his usual weekend of golfing and palm beaching, but he also took a trip to Miami to deliver an address on Venezuela that was filled with warnings for the Maduro regime, as well as a preview of some attacks he's likely to use in his 2020 reelection campaign, particularly here in Florida. We will talk about that on the podcast. Also, John Kennedy will tell us about a sanctuary cities bill that cleared a hurdle in Tallahassee this past week. And Zach Anderson will talk about a rift within the ACLU in Southwest Florida and what the implications are for that. And because, as I mentioned at the top, spring training has returned to Florida, we'll hear from Major League Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis about the importance of baseball in the Sunshine State. But first, I hear some funky royalty-free music playing. And listeners of the podcast know that means it's time for our Pick a Number segment. That's the portion of the podcast where each of us puts forward a number, and then later on, we explain what that number means in Florida politics. John Kennedy, would you favor us by going first with your number, please?
I sure would, George. My number is 12 this week. 12.
12 for John Kennedy in Tallahassee. And I sat down on my notes here, and we encourage all listeners of the podcast to take notes, especially during the Pick a Number segment, as long as you're not driving a car or operating heavy machinery. So John Kennedy with a 12. Zach Anderson, what's your number?
George, my number this week is 177.
177 for Zach Anderson over in Sarasota. And my number, George Bennett, once again, I guess I'm going to be in the curve buster role. My number is 3,285. So you want to write a 3,285 next to my name, George Bennett. So just to review very quickly, John Kennedy, number 12, Zach Anderson, 177, and George Bennett, 3,285. Remember those numbers, hang on to them, and then at the end of the podcast, we will explain what they mean in Florida politics. But let's get straight to our lineup. Donald Trump was in Miami this past week to deliver a major address on Venezuela. On one level, it was filled with some very specific warnings to the Nicolas Maduro regime and the Venezuelan military officers who are loyal to him about allowing humanitarian aid in the country and not cracking down on political dissent and urging them to recognize National Assembly leader Juan Guaido as the legitimate leader of Venezuela. On another level, it was a sweeping indictment of socialism throughout Latin America, particularly Cuba and Nicaragua. And here is a clip of President Donald Trump from that speech in Miami.
We're here to proclaim a new day is coming in Latin America. It's coming. In Venezuela and across the Western Hemisphere, socialism is dying and liberty, prosperity, and democracy are being reborn.
But, it wasn't strictly a foreign policy address, though. It was also clear that Trump and others in the lineup on in Miami on this week were had the 2020 reelection and domestic politics in mind. With Bernie Sanders and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and others embracing the socialist label in the Democratic Party, Trump used what's likely to be a frequent line of attack in 2020. Here's one example of that.
And so as the United States stands up for democracy in Venezuela, We reaffirm the solidarity with the long-suffering people of Cuba and Nicaragua and people everywhere living under socialist and communist regimes. And to those who would try to impose socialism on the United States, we again deliver a very simple message. America will never be a socialist country.
As you can hear, that was a big applause line in Trump's speech in Miami. And it was a big applause line he used in his State of the Union speech as well. Senator Rick Scott also made this link between socialism in Latin America and linking socialism in Latin America to the American left. Here's a quote from Rick Scott.
Socialism is unfortunately what many Democrats want to bring to our country. They should take a fat track money trip to Caracas. They should go down to Venezuela. They should look at the poverty, the depression, the human rights abuses, and the death and destruction. They come back here to our country and apologize to the American people for promoting socialism in our country.
All right, so tagging the liberals in America as socialists, a recurring theme in Miami this past week. Question to you, Zach Anderson. You think that's going to be an effective line of attack for Trump and Republicans in 2020? Is it going to work?
Well, Republicans have been trying to tag Democrats as socialists for as long as I can remember. I mean, Barack Obama was called a socialist and a Marxist, and he did pretty well, won two elections. So, you know, this attack, I'm not sure how effective it will be, but the Democrats have certainly moved to the left. I mean, you have Ocasio-Cortez, you have Bernie Sanders. They're providing plenty of ammunition for the Republicans to say that they've, you know, kind of just gone over the edge and that their proposals will be way too expensive. So it is a little bit of a different era for the Democratic Party. And it's possible that it could gain some traction this time around.
John Kennedy, your thoughts?
No, it does seem like something that Republicans can play toward that vast middle of the population that is watching its 401ks doing well right now, or doing moderately well anyway, depending on which day it is in Wall Street or which hour it is. But it can play to that fear that people would think that electing a Democrat is going to result in economic policies that hurt their bottom line. We saw a little bit of that during the Florida governor's race last year when it was Ron DeSantis, the Republican, successfully defeating Democrat Andrew Gillum, with a lot of the same kind of themes where electing Gillum, who was running as a progressive, who was advocating an increase in the state's corporate income tax, minimum wage increase, that these were all alarming policies that were going to help the underclass, but would hurt the folks that are sort of in the middle and upper income brackets in Florida. So I think it's something that we're going to see Republican candidates exploit against this Democratic field as it starts taking shape for the presidential race.
Yeah, you mentioned Andrew Gillum, and I went back, and there's a clip. As Zach pointed out, I think conservatives kind of devalued the word socialism by using it so much against Barack Obama and anybody on the left in the past. But now, you do have people like Bernie Sanders and AOC, espousing this, at least this kind of faculty lounge version of socialism here. Not quite the same as it is in Latin America, but I thought it was interesting before the Democratic primary, Gillum was asked a few different times after Bernie Sanders endorsed him. I know at one debate I asked Gillum, do you consider yourself a Democratic socialist like Sanders? And he said, he didn't say yes or no. He said, well, I'm a strong progressive. And here's another example from the campaign, just a little audio clip of Gillum being asked about whether he's a socialist. Let's play that one, please.
Are you socialists? Are you capitalists?
I am a Democrat and an individual in this state who believes that we've had a rough ride these last several years. People are working, many of them harder than ever, and still can't bring down a wage where they can make ends meet. And so I realize that these labels are easy to throw on folks, but when you're struggling, when you want to make sure that you can work one job instead of multiple jobs as a way to make ends meet, these labels mean nothing. And so what I'm standing for is what is the everyday lived experience of people in this state. And I believe that they need a champion, too.
One of the reasons I think that Gillum didn't really directly say, no, I'm not a socialist, is there was a Gallup poll in August that found that 57% of Democrats, remember that, and that answer we just heard from Gillum was before the Democratic primary, 57% of Democrats in August in a Gallup poll had a positive view of socialism, and only 47% had a positive view of capitalism. Now, you know, socialism was not defined when they asked that question. And you know, as we said, I think socialism has kind of become synonymous with just progressivism or whatever. But but here, I think in Florida, certainly to the audience that Trump was speaking to Latin Americans and people that, maybe from Venezuela or Cuba or Nicaragua, socialism has a little different connotation than it might in America. And, you know, in a close election like the governor's race or the Senate race, that might have peeled away a few votes from the Democrats, their embrace or at least, you know, not distancing themselves from socialism.
I think it's a tricky issue for Democrats. As you mentioned, their party, a lot of their party really has a favorable view of socialism, but especially in Florida, you have a lot of folks who have experienced socialism firsthand in South America and did not come away with a favorable view of it at all. And in fact, we're living in abject poverty. So it was an effective attack for DeSantis in Florida. He basically had two messages: that Gillum is corrupt and that he's a socialist, and that he won the election. You know, he won it very narrowly by 32,000 votes. So you could argue that there's a lot of factors that put him over the top. But certainly the socialist message was really front and center in his campaign, and he ended up prevailing. Will it work at the national level? You know, that's the big question. Can Trump take that, what happened in Florida, and take it national? He can probably have an effective message here in Florida and potentially win the state again. But does that appeal to folks in Wisconsin and in Michigan? I'm not sure. Part of it will depend on who his opponent is. If he has a much more liberal opponent, it could make it easier for him to define that person as just a big spending socialist.
One other note on that Venezuela rally, it was filled with warnings to Maduro and the Venezuelan military, but among all the tough talk directed at them, Governor Ron DeSantis was one of the speakers, and he had some words of warning for the U.S. about following through on its pledges of solidarity to Venezuela and Latin America. Let's hear that clip of Governor DeSantis.
All people are now looking at what happens here. And if we don't deliver, if we don't stand with the people of Venezuela and their aspirations for freedom and democracy and free and fair elections, then that's going to be a body blow to the cause of freedom, not just in Latin America, but throughout the world. We will be saying that the Castros and the Ortegas are the victory in this conflict, and we can't let that happen.
Interesting perspective from DeSantis, because certainly at that rally in Miami, there was a lot of, you know, pledges to stand with the Venezuelan people against the Maduro regime. So we'll have to see how that plays out. Well, let's move on to Tallahassee. John Kennedy, sanctuary cities, topic that was brought up a lot by Trump during the 2016 campaign and Republicans. What's going on with that? There's legislation in Tallahassee this year. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's legislation that would require Florida communities to help enforce federal immigration laws. This would basically ban what are called sanctuary cities. And this finally made it through the Senate's Judiciary Committee this week. This was on its second go around before that committee. A week earlier, the bill stalled amid a lot of testimony and real confusion about its overall effect. And an effort by its sponsor, Senator Joe Gruter, is a Sarasota Republican. He was trying to make it a little bit more palatable in a Senate, which really doesn't seem all that fired up about trying to crack down on immigration. Now, of course, this really isn't a problem in Florida. Records show that no cities or counties currently have policies designed to stiff-arm federal immigration officials pursuing undocumented residents. But Gruter's doubles as the state's Republican Party chairman, and he was also President Trump's 2016 Florida chairman. So symbolism is important. And while he may be ready to push a tougher standard on Florida cities and counties, he's sort of trying to thread a needle in the Senate and what it will go along with. Now, in this case, Gruter's agreed to take out a provision that would have led to the removal of an elected official who failed to report any violation of the law that would be created. The law overall requires that law enforcement officials honor all requests made by federal immigration and customs officials. And Gruter's tried to give a little bit of an explanation of why he was trying to not make it so onerous on city officials to enact. And here's Gruter's explaining why he has softened this bill.
We didn't want to be vengeful and with this bill, and we didn't want to be we wanted to take some of the aggressiveness out towards our local officials. We want them to comply with the law as exists, and there are still penalties. They could still be sued.
So he also dropped a proposal that could have led to an indefinite holding of a suspect who was an undocumented immigrant. Now, if federal immigration officials want someone accused of a crime detained in a county jail because of questions about their legal status, it can't be more than 48 hours under the bill that Gruter's is advancing now. But these changes didn't do all that much to ease what remains clear opposition from immigration groups. A lot of representatives of farm workers in Florida and really most Democratic legislators. While only undocumented offenders are accused of serious crimes would be the people that would be subject to immigration attention under Gruter's bill, many fear that cases where an undocumented worker stopped for, you know, a minor traffic offense, they could quickly face deportation proceedings. Here's how one advocate, this is Ingrid Delgado with the Florida Conference of Catholic Bishops. This is how she saw it.
We share with the frustration with a broken immigration system, but what we need is comprehensive immigration reform at the federal level, not patchwork piecemeal systems at the state level.
So the bill got through the Judiciary Committee, and that's a big step in a committee which derailed similar legislation last year, though under different leadership. Governor Ron DeSantis, he's endorsed the idea of barring sanctuary cities, but he really hasn't weighed in on the Gruter's plan yet. But the House, which has approved tougher legislation, they appear ready to stand to go ahead and approve the idea. But the bill still faces a long journey through this legislature. There are signs that Gruter's decision to remove the penalties against local officials who could defy the law, that may make it trouble in the House. And leaders that in the House, they may want to go further and not only penalize elected scofflaws, you know, locally, but allow those who get picked up to be held longer. So going forward, I'd say right now, it looks like watch for the House to try to toughen up this delicate bargain that Gruter thinks he's achieved with opponents in the Senate.
All right. Thanks for that, John. Quick question for you. Sanctuary cities has been a Republican talking point for a while, but what's been the reluctance in the Republican-controlled Florida Senate in the past to passing something on this?
Yeah, it has been a very, in Florida, it's a very inflammatory issue within Hispanic communities, I would say. And a past committee chairman of that Judiciary Committee was a Miami state senator and was very sensitive to the impact in his community. Some of that has changed. That senator is no longer in the Senate, and that has changed a little bit of the dynamic. But I think you still have a broader sensitivity in the Senate right now to the groups that are coming forward saying that law enforcement could misuse this legislation if it's passed. And I think they're cognizant that there could be some problems for groups where people are held as suspected undocumented immigrants when perhaps they're not. when they're yeah. And you know, the whole idea of racial profiling is always a undercurrent of a bill like this.
So a good example of a national issue and how it plays out at the state level. And speaking of that, Zach Anderson, tell us a little bit about a conflict going on within the ACLU in Southwest Florida.
Yeah, so the ACLU chapter in Sarasota has really been in turmoil lately, and it might be a bit of a warning for the ACLU nationally. It also has some implications for the ACLU of Florida, because the folks involved in the local chapter are also leaders with the statewide organization, which is hugely influential, passed the Amendment 4 Felons' Right to Vote initiative last year, has a $6.5 million budget. So, you know, a big player in state politics, and the local chapter officials are involved at the state level as well. You know, the story basically is, you know, the ACLU is a pretty well-established organization. They've been around for a long time, but they saw a pretty big influx of new members after Trump was elected. And many of these members are Democrats who want the ACLU to act as a check on Trump, which it has been doing, you know, filing lawsuits against Trump's Muslim ban and his policy of separating children from their families at the border. But the ACLU also has a very specific mission to protect civil liberties, and that doesn't always align with the goals of the Democratic Party. And that has led to some turmoil within the Sarasota chapter. One of the people who joined the ACLU after Trump's election was a man named Kramer Verde, who became vice president of the Sarasota chapter. And Verde also is deeply involved with the Democratic Party, which objected last year to the ACLU supporting a ballot initiative here in Sarasota to change the date of the city's municipal elections. The ACLU wanted to move the elections so that they coincide with state and national elections, the idea being that those are higher turnout elections and it will increase voter participation in the municipal elections if they're coincide with these higher turnout elections. And increasing voter participation is a major goal of the ACLU. Well, the Democratic Party didn't want to change the date of the municipal elections. The lower turnout elections have worked out just fine for them. All five Sarasota city commissioners are Democrats. So Verde got into some arguments with the new ACLU chapter president, and he eventually quit the chapter, as did a majority of the chapter's board members, which again has thrown the organization into turmoil. Now, Verde says he wasn't trying to impose the Democratic Party's agenda on the ACLU, and that he and others left the chapter because they felt disrespected and there was a lack of civility. But a number of people told me that he was basically trying to make the ACLU reflect the views of the Democratic Party. And if that's the case, it could be a warning for the group nationwide that this big influx of new members could present some problems for the organization if they're trying to push a nonpartisan agenda. And as I said, the turmoil is also noteworthy because the ACLU chapter president locally is Susan Nylon. She serves as secretary of the ACLU of Florida board. And one of the local board members is Michael Barfield, who is president of the state board. So you have two leaders of the ACLU of Florida who are having trouble keeping their own local chapter from descending into chaos, which might say something about their ability to lead this state organization, which I said has been hugely influential, passed Amendment 4, one of the biggest voter enfranchisement efforts in recent history in this country. You know, roughly 1.5 million ex-felons became eligible to vote through that. So a pretty influential organization. And if this turmoil spreads, it could limit the effectiveness of the ACLU statewide.
Very interesting, Zach. Thanks a lot for that. Well, as I mentioned at the top, spring training has begun in Florida. And that means every winter, the Florida has something called the Governor's Baseball Dinner. And this year's Governor's Baseball Dinner, the media credentials for it featured a picture of Ron DeSantis in his Yale baseball uniform at bat. DeSantis played and was a pretty good ball player at Yale. He was captain of the team at Yale in around 2001. Another former Yale baseball captain was George H.W. Bush back in the 1940s. But the annual Governor's Baseball Dinner always, you know, celebrates the link between baseball and Florida through spring training.
And here is Baseball Commissioner Rob Manfred. He was at the dinner in West Palm Beach talking about that topic.
We try to be good partners to all of our important partners, and we do believe that we deliver economic benefit to the state of Florida. I think last year the estimate was $700 million in revenue and 7,000 jobs, and we're going to work hard to make sure that that continues to happen.
There is this is a politics podcast, and there's always a political angle with baseball in Florida, mainly that the 15 teams that train in Florida, I think all of them are playing in facilities that were funded entirely or largely by public money. For the ballpark of the Palm Beaches, for example, here in West Palm Beach, that was just completed a couple seasons ago for the Astros and Washington Nationals, included a lot of local hotel tax money and I think $50 million from the state of Florida. And it's, you know, the classic argument that baseball brings out of state visitors and generates revenue. And so spending public money on it is an investment that that gets a good return. Here's what Ron DeSantis had to say about baseball in Florida.
I just think it's great that we're doing this in Florida. We're always open for all the clubs. We love having you guys here. I'm here as governor to do whatever I can to make sure that baseball remains an important part of our state. And I look forward to being able to make it up some of the parks this year. So I'll just say thank you guys for coming. Thanks, Palm Beach County, for hosting us. And let's play ball.
All right. Let's play ball. Yeah. It's kind of like Everglades Preservation or a few other issues in Florida. Spending public dollars on spring training has been one of those rare issues that unites politicians from both parties, and liberals and conservatives. When it comes to baseball in Florida, they have historically been willing to play ball. All right. Well, I think I hear some kind of funky royalty-free music playing again. There it is. That means it's time to get back to our pick a number segment. So note takers, bust out your notes. John Kennedy, number 12. Could you please explain that number to us?
Sure. George, 12 is the number of dollars that it's going to set you back to order a Governor DeSantis's delicious salad bar buffet at the Tallahassee restaurant Andrews, which is a block from the state capitol. Now, Andrews has been around about 45 years, as you know, which for Florida terms, it's practically a historic landmark, and it's known for its menu items that are named after Florida politicians. Well, this week, the post-election menu was unveiled in sort of grand fashion, with a few of the celebrated menu people actually showing up at the restaurant for the event, although not DeSantis. Now I've been stopping at Andrews for most of the years it's open, sadly, and that salad bar has been there the whole time, although not named the DeSantis Delicious. Somebody once told me they expected Andrew's owner, Andy Reese, to be buried in that salad bar when his time comes. It's that iconic. But at $12, DeSantis's salad bar is one of the thriftier items on the lunch menu. You could get a Lieutenant Governor Nunez pastrami Miami dip for $13, or President Galvano's Grand Kimchi Salmon Burger, also for $13. So basically ordering the DeSantis, you know, you can save a buck.
Wow. You wouldn't associate DeSantis necessarily with a salad bar, but there you go. And only 12 bucks, less than the LG's specialty. When you're in Tallahassee, little dining tip there. Okay, Zach Anderson, 177.
George, I was going to say that 177 is your batting average, and that's why you're still unsigned as spring training kicks off. But we all know you could at least get in the 200s, so I don't think that would be fair. $177 million is the amount devoted to military construction projects in Florida that could be swept to pay for the border wall under Trump's executive order. That includes projects at MacDill Air Force Base in Tampa, Mayport Naval Station in Jacksonville, Eglin Air Force Base in the Panhandle. This executive order freed up Trump to use some of this military money for the wall, but it could be controversial. I mean, you know, members of Congress are pretty territorial about protecting the military institutions in their states. So if you start seeing, some headlines about some of this money being diverted, I think that could start to erode some of this support for the executive order. The Tampa Bay Times had some good reporting on this week. This money has not been diverted yet, and it's not clear that it ever would be, that any of these projects in Florida would actually lose out in the long run. But they are up for grabs here, so we'll see what happens.
Yeah, that'll be something interesting to watch, especially for a guy like Senator Rick Scott, who came out very much in favor of the president's emergency declaration. But if you know, it comes down to moving money out of some of these Florida projects, it'll be interesting to see how he responds to that. Well, my number was 3,285. That is the average number of out-of-state fans at a spring training game in Florida, according to a economic impact study that was done on spring training last year. The average spring training game in Florida draws 6,318 fans, and they calculate that 52% of those fans, or 3,285, are from out of state. Now, as we mentioned before, the selling point and why Republicans and Democrats alike have historically been willing to put up public dollars for spring training facilities is that it brings in out-of-state guests who spend money on hotels and restaurants and things while they're here. And it's this particular study, economic impact studies are always, you should take them with a shaker of salt, but it estimates that spring training had a $687 million impact on Florida's economy in 2018. Well, that concludes our Pick a Number segment, and that concludes another one of our Inside Florida Politics podcasts. I am Palm Beach Post staff writer George Bennett. It has been my honor to be your host. I've been joined by from Tallahassee by Gatehouse State Capitol Bureau Chief John Kennedy, and from Sarasota by Zach Anderson, the politics editor at the Sarasota Herald Tribune. And I've been assisted here in West Palm Beach by Corzano. That's the team of Thomas Cordy and Joe Forzano. And rejoining the podcast, the man behind the curtain, the Gatehouse Digital Audio Director, Adam Fish. Thank you.